the rocket race start take over and the global communications got better, that's what I'm calling the solar government. In actual fact, they are an elite within the world government, if you were more practical about it and dumb. But it was I call it the solar government because it was responding to the planetary structure that was, you know, being surrounded by satellites. So that's really what we were, the Secret Council of Ten. We were floating above the world government. So, yeah, Gerd Stern, he was a famous letter that Neil Cassidy wrote to Jack Kerouac. Ginsberg got a hold of it, gave it to Gerd. Gerd returned it, but Ginsberg lost it, blamed Gerd. So it's been famous in beatnik circles for 50 to 60 years that Gerd Stern lost the most important document, because that letter was an 18-page rant by Neil Cassidy that inspired the style of Kerouac's On the Road.
Oh, no kidding?
Yeah,
I thought
kidding.
Cassidy was sort of incidental to Kerouac. I didn't realize he was Kerouac's inspiration.
Yeah, you don't know the story. You don't know enough about beatnik. Have you read any beatnik books? No. You don't know the details. So there's no big deal you don't know this. So it was legendary. And no one knew about the letter to Kerouac in 1968, announced in an interview in Paris Review, one of those culture magazines. He laid out the fact that Kerouac had inspired him. Now, the question is, Kerouac died in 68. Did he die, and then Jack Kerouac gets interviewed and decided to hoik up his friend and made up this story? You have to look at when was the date of the interview and when was the date that Kerouac died in 68. I don't know. I don't have the Paris Review archive, so you can look that up and see if they match. That might have been the little conspiracy that Jack Kerouac launched. But anyways, it became legendary, and then about 2 years ago, this woman found it, because her father was involved in the publishing, and you can hear about this. And then they figured out it was the letter. So Jerry Cimino, who I just met in March, middle of March 2013, I went in there, became his friend. He got intrigued by me. I told him I knew Gerd Stern. We called Gerd Stern, and this guy, Jerry Cimino, at the Beat Museum, which is right near the City Lights bookstore, put me and Gerd on his advisory council. So that was that. That was March 2013. So then I'm talking to Gerd, arranging him to renew his RNA drops, you know, a month ago. And Gerd said, had I seen the news about the letter? And I said, no, I didn't know what he was talking about. I didn't know about the letter. So he told me, I looked it up, and I said, holy shit. And in the article, it says that when Jerry Cimino called Gerd to tell him they found the letter, that Gerd said, wow, 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 20 times. And then Jerry says, Gerd started to laugh. And he said, I never heard anybody laugh as long as Gerd laughed at that insight or at that news. So it was a big release for Gerd, and I'm taking fucking credit for it, because I asked Ion, I think we asked it right on here, go back a few weeks, maybe I can find it and play it. I asked Ion, did you place that letter there? And Ion says, we certainly did.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ion said, a lot more are going to be placed there. So I told that to Gerd, who's on the drops and knows a bit about Ion, but I don't think he listens or anything, but he knows a bit, he knows something what we're doing. I told him this, and he says, I don't doubt it, Bob. So here's this inside story that involves us, and you can go to the Beat Museum at Kerouac.com and look at the press conference they held on December 27th. It's really good. It's about an hour long, and you can watch Gerd and Cimino and the other guy who found it talk about it. It's a really good hour-long thing. But you'll have the extra insight that it was fucking Dobbstown that caused this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can look at Gerd being interviewed, and then you say, there's that 86-year-old guy. He lived. The rest of them all died. And he talks about how he and Ginsberg tried to anal rape him, all kinds of incredible stories. Gerd starts first. He starts it first. And, you know, he's the one who gave Ginsberg his first marijuana joint. It's all in this interview. It's absolutely incredible. I mean, Garrett's very important. You got the 24 hours, you hear all this stuff. And here he is, the only one of the beatniks, hardly anybody else still around. And he's on the drops, and while he's on the drops, this miracle happens. And you can watch him be dumbfounded.
Did it help to establish who lost the letter when the letter was recovered?
Oh, yeah. Gerd was right. He had returned it. Yeah, it all got proven and validated that Gerd was not lying. He didn't lose it. And it was all silly. And it was just another prank by Ginsburg, who always had a problem with Gerd. And Gerd explains this. Ginsburg thought everybody should be a homosexual. And they resented that Gerd would not become homosexual, so they fucking tried to rape him. When they attempted to rape him in the early 50s, him and I think Kerouac might have been there, or Neil Cassidy and a couple other guys, the guy that was supposed to stick his dick into Gerd's bum couldn't get it up, so Gerd was saved.
They were holding him down or something?
Yes, they were holding him down.
Oh, God.
Listen. Ginsburg, he's in the hospital with Carl Solomon, who's Ginsburg's hero. He's the guy that Howell's all about. But Gerd's there first, then Carl, they meet. And there's some phatic exchange when Gerd meets the guy. He's holding a big pile of books. This is Carl Solomon. And Gerd says, hello. And the guy, he drops the books out of his hands and shakes Gerd's hand, and he says, define your terms. He says something. Gerd says something like "Hello" or "How you doing?" And the guy drops the books, shakes his hand, and says, "Define your terms." and so they become friends. And about a month later, Ginsburg shows up. So then the three of them become very mischievous in this nut house. But it's a place where young Jewish intellectuals and poets can go to. And so they hang out there pretending they're screwed up, and they cause all these pranks. And then Gerd goes out. He gets on leave, and he's allowed to go out. So he gets some marijuana and brings it back in, gives it to Ginsburg, and I guess Carl. I'm not sure about Carl. And then Ginsburg reports Gerd. He fucking turns him in. And so Gerd gets kicked out of the lunatic place, and he's glad. He says right there in the interview, you hear him refer to this. He says, I was glad to go. I was sick of the place. So even though Ginsburg was an asshole, it worked out. So he said there was always an ongoing issue between him and Gerd. You know, and here it is. He cites a poem he wrote. He says, Alan died, Jack died, I didn't, I'm still here. I think that's the poem. It's a great story.
I remember when you interviewed him for Wiretaps, and I thought he was a very gentle and a thoughtful man.
Oh, he is.
He seemed, you know, like he didn't fall for the glitz and glamour of the beatnik stuff.
Exactly. He went to he created every fucking movement. He was a friend of McLuhan. He gave me McLuhan's correspondence with him. He started the digital stuff before anybody. He built the stage at Woodstock and then had to take it down and go to Max Yazger's farm and redo it again, you know, a week later.
Dang.
It's incredible. Every scene, he's there. He engineered Alan Watts at KPFA in the 50s. On the radio.
I guess the thing that impressed me about him was that he seemed so, I don't know if humble is the right word, but he just didn't toot his horn. He seemed, you know, very casual about it all.
Well, that's what he is. He's aware. You know, that's why he's scared, why he's still alive and everybody else is dead. I mean, he's cosmic, you know.
Well, isn't this an interesting twist to replaying the 60s?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's a good point. I got to remember, I'm doing all this. We're redoing the 60s and reestablishing the good word for everybody who takes the drops. And if you don't take the drops, you're the fucking guy who lost the letter.
And now Gert's going to be alive a lot longer, a lot longer.
That's right. That's right. No, that's really good. We are rewriting. That's a good point. Ion started to rewrite the 60s, but I mean, Gerd probably did throw the fucking letter away, but we're now in another world, so Gerd gets rehabilitated.
But this is a replay of the 60s with a major figure of the 60s still in play.
Wow.
Working for Dobbstown. See, this is the point. It's going to be all redone, so me and Carol, who were behind the scenes always, no one knew, it'll become more obvious, and this is a good example. Yes, we could have done it all in 69. Manson wouldn't have happened. Woodstock wouldn't have happened. It would have been real boring from that point on if Ian came in then.
How about the replay of where the people are? You said that Ion said that how did you put it? The people, the 60s, the movement was genuine.
Yeah.
Is it the same now? It's not.
No, it's not. There's no social movement, you know, like that. That was the last, I don't know, that was like the last gasp of, I could put it in McLuhan terms, it was the last gasp of the chemical body. And there was something genuine that prompted, inspired the chemical body for all the enthusiasms that happened. But there was the Android meme phase that had to come, which McLuhan was predicting. You know, that's the neat part about McLuhan and Finney's Wake, that humans didn't know that their technologies were going to have their day before you got to the newer technologies. The non-physical technologies could have started with the D-cell or an improvement of the D-cell in 69. That's when we started taking the D-cell. And that's when he's saying it could have gone a different way. But I'm glad we wouldn't have had a 36-hour music fucking broadcast if we take it over in the 60s.
Bob, what about the pickle farmer down there in Louisiana?
Oh, before we go into that, Andrew, I wanted to tell you, I actually found, I don't know, someone had on my Facebook page that James Martinez was a friend of mine. You know how these faces show up that you're connected to. So I went over and clicked on his site and said, oh, look, he's got a Facebook page. And then I looked at it and said, oh, I'm a friend of his because, you know, how it shows you. If you're shown, you can comment. You're in there, right? You're a friend. So I decided to private message him. So I said, you fucking asshole. You still owe me money. You're not responding to me. And I said, and look at this. And I posted the Andrew's video, you know. So he fucking, we'll see if he looked at it.
This is a friend? This is, okay.
No, wait, what do you mean? What do you mean a friend? This is James Martinez, the night that, you know, we raided his hotel room.
No, of course. I'm just saying that the guy that posted on the Facebook, he was a friend of James, or he was
Nobody posted on Facebook. I'm saying that I noticed that there was, I didn't know James had a Facebook page, but over on the side of your own personal Facebook page, you'll see this, they'll have a picture of somebody you don't even know, and they'll say, you know six people, you're connected to this guy. Through six people, right? You know what that is. Any people know
that? No, I don't, but go ahead.
Yeah, it shows you.
James Martinez?
Yes! No. It's his picture and everything. Oh. And, you know, it tells you who you're connected to. They say you have six mutual friends. So somehow, you know, on my page or somewhere I saw that I had mutual friends with James. So I saw he had a Facebook page. So I went over there, and I saw I could give him a message, and that I could even start posting on the threads on his site and interfering, but I decided just to send him a private message. And I said, hey, asshole. And I laid out my grievance and then gave him the video. So I'm telling you, Andrew, because, you know, we didn't know if he had seen the video. And, well, now it's right there in his private message. And that's a couple of days ago. I haven't heard back. The fucking guy's not responding.
Maybe he's blocked you from his Facebook.
No, I got in there. I got in there. Wrote the message, and it said message delivered. I'm not blocked.
I know, but now he could still block you now.
Oh, yeah, now he could. Now he could. Yeah, I'll go over there next week, see if he's blocked me, if I don't hear from him. Oh, I know what I did. I gave him an insult that hurt. I said, you're turning into a Peggy. And I didn't say the whole thing, but he knows what I mean by that. That's something that would really bother him if he's still human.
Who's Peggy?
That's unlike you, Bob.
Well, come on. You saw me in that video, man. No one ever saw me act like that before. Pounding on everybody's door at 3 in the morning. I do have a pass, though. I do have resources for myself.
You hell, pass? You got a present. What do you mean?
Yeah, I'm redoing the 60s. I started off by banging on James's door. That's 1961. Kennedy is now president. I am pissed because Nixon was supposed to get in. And I'm Gordon Liddy going around forming the secret plumbers team to assassinate Kennedy. That was the opening beginning. I look like a CIA guy in that video.
That would have been interesting to see, that's for sure.
What?
Everybody looks so stiff.
Yeah, but what are you saying? It would be interesting to see the video?
No, it would be interesting to see you back then, because everybody seems so stiff in all the recordings that we see.
Okay, in the recordings you're seeing, you mean history recordings?
That's right. What else do I have?
Well,
I'm 4 years old at the time.
I'm one of the few people in the world who's never changed. The way I am now is the way I was back then.
Well, there you go. Yeah. It would be interesting to see, like a duck out of water, I'm telling you.
Well, like, I try to show it the diaries. I mean, Hoover kicked me out of the fucking building. That's right there in the diaries, right? I was always being escorted out. I used to confuse people. I'd be knowledgeable in what they're talking about, but I didn't seem to have the same seriousness that everybody had. And my smirk would eventually, just like in the Dobbs head, my smirk would eventually bother these very serious, motivated fascists, you know? And they didn't like it. They said, get the fuck out of here. They would accuse me of not taking anything seriously.
You had a failure to communicate, obviously.
Yes, I was not. I didn't understand where I was and what the stakes were.
You were talking right in that environment.
Mm-mm.
Talking right, did you say?
You were talking right.
Talking right, talking correctly?
Well, you had to be literal. You had to do the literal, you know, two-step or whatever. You know, everybody likes to have been looking.
Oh. Wait a minute. Now, you're quoting Ian when you say you don't talk right. Is that what you're referring to, Susanna?
Yes. Yes.
No, I talked okay. It wasn't that I talked a lot. I didn't talk a lot. I wasn't allowed to, but I had a twinkle in my eye that was disconcerting, you know. It's exactly like the Bob's head. That's what everybody says. They look at the church subgenius Dobbs head and they say, there's some look in there. I don't understand that guy. He's smiling about something. I don't know what he's smiling about.
You know what surprised me was when you met Faustin Bray, and she was with Sounds Photosynthesis, she had recorded Terrence McKenna, John Lilly, Robert Anton Wilson. She was close to everybody who was happening at the time.
Yeah.
And what, she gave you a 30-minute interview and never published it? And I was like, my God, how could someone with that caliber of friend not get Bob?
Well, here's what happened, Scott. I'll give exactly. You guys ever heard of the State of the World Forum? Probably September 1990 at the United Nations. Okay, you look it up. State of the World Forum. Oh, wait a minute. Was it 2000? What year was that? That was 2000. State of the World Forum. James Garrison organized it, and they had Pentagon Colin spoke there. So I went there with Jim George. He had a pass, the United Nations pass, and Jim George is the guy who turned us on to Mir. He was the ambassador that saved the documents, the Dalai Lama documents. I've mentioned him before. So he's an interesting man, ambassador to many countries. So he takes me to the State of the World Forum. So I somehow come across Faustin and that gang, and they're trying to do interviews with anybody they can do. So I hang around and observe them because I knew who they were, you know what I mean, more than they knew about me. And eventually I said enough that Faustin said, I should interview you this week. And so it went over for a couple of days, I think. Or maybe it was all one day. I'm not sure. But I spent a long time in their room, in her, You know what her boyfriend's name was? He worked with Jack DeFatty.
Ryan.
What?
Oh, no, she had a new boyfriend by then. Yeah, I forget his name.
He had an odd name, and he was a main associate of Jack DeFatty. So I watched that guy standing there with his computer on the counter, just standing and typing. I'd never really seen anybody standing and typing on the computer, but he was doing a lot of digital stuff while she was running around organizing interviews and going to some speeches. So I sat there for many hours just sort of doing small talk whenever she had a break. After a while, it became, she realized, no, this Bob guy, there's something different. This is not good. We can't have him sitting here watching us like this for hours. So she started to avoid putting off the interview and just not getting to it. And the day was winding down. So I kept staying around, and so I built up enough waiting many hours that she had to do something. You know, she couldn't just say, okay, you waited 8 hours, forget it, we're not going to do it. She said, okay, let's do the interview, and let's make it fast. So she was going to do a perfunctory interview, like, let's just go through the motions. So knowing that, she asked me the first question. I started talking real fast. And so I put in about 2 hours of information in 22 minutes. I just talked about it was totally absurd. And she didn't care. She was just trying to get over, but she probably was intrigued by she'd ask a question, and I'd just go on rapidly with a whole bunch of shit. So she recorded it, and it's absurdly me talking fast. And then I got Scott, you know, a month or two later to try to order it, and Scott spent 6 months trying to get them to even find it, acknowledge it, and in the end never got it, never had it, and denied it existed. And she might have thrown it away, you know, because it was all in an odd pitch, timbre, rhythm. She didn't want to do it. I said, okay, you're going to have to do it, but I'm going to say as much as I can, as fast as possible, knowing you're only going to give me 22 minutes.
She was a fan of William Irwin Thompson and recorded a lot of his lectures.
Yes, but see, they don't know.
You know, what's strange about you, Bob, is that the average person wouldn't stand around for 8 hours and not feel insulted.
Well, I knew a lot about them, and I was spying on them. See, that's what they start. The human being starts to notice that this guy's doing something else here. It gets uncomfortable. Their normal instinct, their normal intuition says, "What the fuck is this guy doing?" He'd normally go out and have to have a coffee or have to use the bathroom. He doesn't want to fucking have a piss. He doesn't eat. He doesn't do nothing. Just sits there, very attentive to everything. They can't stand that kind of awareness. It gets nervous.
Ulterior motives.
Yes. They got real suspicious. And so she even was, she could easily said, fuck you, we're not doing it. She was scared. She knew she better do something. So they did a token walk through the motions interview, and I knew that, so I just blatted as fast as I could, as much as I wanted to say. I probably nailed everybody in it, as I usually do. Everybody she respected, I fucking nailed.
Go ahead, Bob. Finish your statement.
The thing is, Scott, they don't know McLuhan. If you don't know McLuhan, you fucking don't understand what's going on. You don't even know that Thompson is a replay of McLuhan. You know what I mean? You may like Thompson and all your fantasies of Gaia hypothesis and eco-fascism and that, but if you don't know McLuhan, you don't know what he's about. They didn't know McKenna was into McLuhan. They just didn't have the resource. So they're running around interviewing all these people and being very specialized and not appreciating
the solution. Well, they knew that was Robert Anton Wilson into McLuhan even?
A little bit.
Leary knew about him. Robert Anton Wilson did a really great tape. I know you don't think much of it, but he did a good commentary on Finnegan's Wake. It wasn't McLuhan style, but it was, you know.
No, let me explain that, Scott. He came to Toronto in 1985, and I didn't know about him. I don't think I knew about him. But I heard all the young kids at CKLM were going to go see this new mind, this new intellectual. And I knew they should be listening to me. So I said, who the fuck's this guy? They don't recognize me. Go see this idiot. So I went up there to the Toronto Library, and there's Robert Anton Wilson. He starts talking, and he does this sort of corny, semi-Bucky Fuller stuff. It wasn't that impressive. It is impressive that he would talk about Bucky Fuller and Finnegan's Wake and this and that. You know what I mean? He was hip for the Generation Xers. That was okay. So in the question period, I brought up McLuhan. And he says, well, I knew about McLuhan. I read his book in 1948, Mechanical Bride. I said, the book didn't come out until 1951. How'd you do that? He says, I don't know. And so I started to call him on a few things that he was saying. And he quickly learned to fucking stop answering me and answering and listen to other people. So I had it in for him. Then I met May Brussel in I already knew May. So when I got a hold of Cosmic Trigger, and that's the fourth book of his Illuminatus trilogy. No, yes, it's the fourth phase, fourth book. And in it, he criticizes May Brussel. So I said. I said, that's not going to go. This, and I talked to May about him, and she didn't like him. So I was waiting for my opportunity to get him, and it happened on May 29th, 1993, the first time I was on KPFK in David Porter's Genesis of a Music, and we could play it. I've played it before. It's right there on my archive, where in our battle he faints. I win.
I know. I heard that show. I thought, what an honor. Robert Anton Wilson's calling into the show, and then you read him the Riot Act, and he doesn't even know how to respond.
No, what happened, Scott? The fake Robert Anton Wilson called in.
Yeah, I remember that first, but then that was just an introduction.
The fake guy calls in, and I had heard. I was listening to Roy of Hollywood's show Monday night. He had Leary. They were leading up to the Millennium Madness on May 29th, 93 in L.A. with Leary, Krasner, and all the guys. And they were celebrating, 2000 coming. So they had Leary on Monday. They had Thompson on Wednesday night. And then I was on Saturday. So I heard the fake Robert Anton Wilson talking to Thompson, to Robert Anton Wilson. So I got up on that. I caught up, and this is like 2 or 3 in the morning. Everybody, Jerry's asleep, Karen's asleep, but I'm on fucking duty. I'm monitoring what's the battle. I don't even know what's going to happen, but it's going to happen, so I'm monitoring it. And so I realized the fake guy. So then I get on the show, my first show. The fake Robert Anton Wilson phones in. And pretty quickly, I realized who he was. And so I don't know if I called him on it right away, but the guy started praising me, saying I was way better than the Church Sub Genius, way better than the real Robert Anton Wilson. And the guy basically said he wished he was me. But everybody thought it was Robert Anton Wilson saying this. But it wasn't. Because when he hung up, and we get another call, and it's a guy who is sponsoring the Millennium Madness. And he complains. He said, you guys just had the fake Robert Anton Wilson. Now you're going to hear the real one. He's staying with me. We're going to do the Millennium Madness this afternoon. Here's Robert Anton Wilson. So he comes on, and then all of history had converged to this moment, which I hadn't even rehearsed for. But I was ready. I was ready. And I immediately blasted what am I saying? Robert Anton Wilson, yeah. Did I say Robert Anton Thompson? No, I didn't say that. No. Robert Anton Wilson, I blast him. I blast him for fucking May Brussel. In other words, as soon as he showed up, the file popped up in my head, the whole list of grievances from 6 years before, and immediately I spewed them out. And then that threw him off, and then he got silly, and then I reminded him of the Toronto Library and how stupid he was there about McLuhan, and bang, 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 bang. He couldn't even rope-a-dope me. And so all of a sudden, the guy who called in and introduced him had the phone and said, I'm sorry, Robert fainted. Robert fell over. Robert's not available. So he says, I said, well, yay, victory or whatever. And he says, don't celebrate too fast, Bob. We're watching you, Bob. We're going to get you. He ends with a fucking threat at the end. It's all there on the timeline. You can hear it. Hilarious. I told the first Robert, the fake Robert Anton Wilson, he said, are you coming to the Millennium? Oh, yeah, I'll be there. So we were planning to meet there, but of course I didn't go. I went to the beach instead. So I didn't know that the real guy would call in right after the fake guy, and then we resolved the issues, knockout punch. If he had not called in, I probably would have gone to the Millennium Madness because I knew I had to confront Wilson because he was in the neighborhood, you know?
You could have been a little more diplomatic, Bob.
No. This is a family feud. This is years of grievance. It involves the Church Sub Genius. Remember, the Church Sub Genius says he's the J.R. Bob Dobbs when they're in a certain mood. They say he's me. So it is a battle. And it did come up, I think, in the dialogue. Someone, Dave Porter, said, well, are you J.R. Bob Dobbs? And he said, yes. Some people say, well, you're talking to the real J.R. Bob Dobbs. And he didn't know what to say to that. So it's all pretty funny. And it was Guffey, Robert Guffey from The Guff, heard that interview. Robert Anton Wilson, he was a young kid, and Wilson was his hero, and he couldn't believe that someone knocked him out. And so he got fascinated by me, and that's led to that article in 2000 in Paranormal Magazine saying The Matrix was about me. It's because little Robert Guffey heard that May 29th, 93 encounter and saw his hero blasted off the planet. And here I am sitting in my victory lap. This whole fucking last 4 or 5 years has been one constant verbal victory lap. I've been boasting for 5 years now.
Hey, Bob.
Yeah.
Bob, hey, I was surfing your diaries looking for your last engagement with Tom Wolfe, and I came across the February 25th, 1999, where you confronted him at Fordham.
You want to hear that? We can play that now.
I already heard it, but I was wondering, has he engaged you since 99?
He doesn't engage with the McLuhan world. He just does his novel world, you know. He just goes and hides and researches his next novel. He showed up lately with something. I saw him being interviewed. He's pretty old now. What did he just do? What did he comment on? The crash of the internet. Oh, yeah, he did that great article I sent around.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, that's where I read that.
Good article.
Yeah, it is. Really good.
Masters of the Universe. See, he's good at sort of giving you semi-inside information in a nice, friendly pattern, and lays it out and makes fun of them and gives you the name of the players. You know, that's a very good article he did.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, I'm thinking of using that on our show with the young people on Tuesday. That's a good beginning thing to... Whatever young people.
What young people are you talking to?
Well, the panel is Jermaine and Leon, and Kate from Vancouver. She's 25. And, you know, Jermaine's about 33 or something, and Leon, I don't know what he is, late 20s, and maybe someone else. Sarah screaming for a role on that, but I wouldn't give Sarah a permanent position. But she's welcome to participate. You know,
so you think they represent a cross section of where young people are at today?
That's all I got. I got my foster daughter, and she said she'd be on, but something came up. She didn't know if she'd be on this week. So, and she's 50 years old. So, but she has two teenagers. So she's a mother who's informed on the problems of being a mother. So. It was just beginning. I don't know who's going to be part of it. It might just be me and Sarah arguing. Me muting her. Unmuting her.
Well, do you think you have a pulse on what is going on with young people? It seems like I don't know if you can generalize anymore. It depends on what young person you're talking to.
Yeah, I'm not there to explain to them what's going on, or find out what they have to say. They can say all they want. I'm there to solve their problems. That's what I'm offering. I'm starting a revolution. I'm going to have the youth, millions of youth, walk down Madison Avenue or Fifth Avenue, all dressed in white with no protest cards, nobody knowing why we're walking.
Better make the YouTube.
That sounds like a Devo revival.
Or a flash mob could be seen as a flash mob that doesn't stop and take their clothes off. So we just maintain interest, because as long as we don't take our clothes off, they got to keep looking at us.
Well, I heard I don't know, it was New Zealand or Australia or a couple of cities around the world, there were gatherings of young people who would get together dressed like zombies and just sort of mill around the city for no particular reason.
Yeah, there's been that. But the thing is all to have the same costume on, so that we're not trying to be individuals. We're just a it might look like zombies, but we're not even, we're walking with a purpose, but nobody knows what the purpose is. A mass army just shows up and walks, you know, for 10 mm-hmm. miles. And everybody said, what are they for? What's their position? What do they think of abortion? Are they for capital punishment? What are the issues here? We don't say nothing. In a way, it would look like an alien invasion. It's just these people walking.
Well, I think of the robots, and I think of the white robots in Star Wars. They're all sort of clones of one another, and they're all depersonalized.
Yeah, okay. We could be that.
But, yeah, I mean, is that a good image for young people to want to aspire to?
Well, the name of the show is...
Loss of Personal Identity.
Hey, Scott, here's the name of the show. What youth? And youth in quotation marks. Like, what is the category of youth? What youth? Question mark. We maintain there are no youth. Who are these people going around pretending they're young people, pretending they need to go to school or go to college, or we're going to rip off their masks? Everybody still here?
Everybody?
Did we get disconnected? Hey.
Hello.
Hey, I got an email. I got an email from Shannon. She says, best laugh ever. She goes, Bob, CW, James, Ion, in that order. Well, who's James? I don't know who he means.
James Martinez, maybe?
I don't think Shannon knows him. Oh, wait, they're talking about laughs. You're right. Okay, yeah, he's not talking about a joke. He's talking about the laugh. So Bob, Carolyn, and James Martinez, and Ion. Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Shannon, why don't you call in and talk about the youth show?
Yeah. Bob, I'll tell you about the youth. I saw some youths there last week, and it was funny. They were on the tablets, good old second graders and whatnot. They got their Apple tablets and whatnot, and I'm hearing voices, and it almost sounds like some early morning FM, you know, where the you know, the banter between the radio hosts and those kind of thing. You know, it's more adult, really. Looking at this thing, they're watching a YouTube of people playing a video game.
Hey, there was something to say to you. Did you hear Corbin said that you and Legend were attacked by demons sent by him? Can you explain that?
All I know is Legend told me that he went and picked him up that night. He you know, it was the New Year get together or whatnot, and picked him up at his place. And he said it was no big deal. Go to the video outlet. And he said when he got there, he said after going to his place, he felt exhausted, like somebody just drained the energy right out of him.
Are you talking about Legend? When did this happen?
This is what Legend told me, yeah, he felt like he had to take a nap.
Okay, you're saying Legend went to pick up Corbin to go get a video?
Right. No. You know, Corbin lives in the video outlet.
Oh, I didn't know that's what
you
was.
Were there.
You went there in the dark. Yeah, I didn't. It was in
where
the dark,
he lives.
There were a lot of videos there.
This is landlord's video hut. Yes.
Right. Is that the store?
Yeah, the Museum of VHS. Yes.
Right. Is that the store?
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. You walk in, there's this tiny little place, and
yeah.
It's like the video hut. It's like
yes. It's
like the Museum of VHS. It's like,
yeah,
well, what
right.
is
yeah.
this? They had a little couch there, and they had a little TV propped up, and it was
that was his.
And the guy in his house, you weren't inside. We went inside for a bit and met the landlord, the gentleman, and he had this. I mean, the biggest. TV that I'd ever seen. I mean, this thing had to have been, like 200 inches by, you know, 120 or some such thing. The thing was just enormous.
Okay.
But as a side, anyway, that's what Legend was telling me. He's like, I went there. I And afterwards, I was just like, it's like, you know, I felt like I had to take a nap, like immediately. And I said, well, you know, he's doing all that magic. He's getting involved with the angels.
So, okay, I missed that again. So wait, so what did he do something with Corbin?
No, he just went to go pick him up. I don't think he was there, or I'm not sure the whole story of to talk to him about, because I'm hearing this all secondhand to begin with. Corbin's not quite correct. I didn't experience anything. This is just what Legend was telling
right.
me.
So Legend goes to pick him up. He's not there. And did you say Legend went to a video store or just went home?
Oh, no. Went to go pick him up at his place or whatever. Went back to his car or something. Anyway, some such thing. He was just telling me that he was just like, he was doing, you know, it was just average.
Very simple.
Day.
He got drained and he never went anywhere after trying to find Corbin. He went home and had to have a nap.
No. I think he said he took a couple-minute nap or whatever in his car. I think waiting for Corbin to show up or some such thing.
Yeah, and then what?
You have to get the whole story from Legend on that.
Well, you did earlier? No, Corbin said that you two combined.
Oh, well, Corbin said, I'm not even sure. God, after listening to that, I'm like, I'm not even sure. What the hell? Corbin implicated me, and I had nothing to do with it. I wasn't even there. I didn't experience anything.
Well, wait, here. We're just trying to get a simple statement.
The simple statement is you really want to talk to Corbin.
Answer a question. Did Corbin show up?
Yes.
Okay, then what?
Well, I guess eventually they go off, and no big deal. They head all off to Legend's house.
Yeah.
But he was just saying that it was odd that he had just felt like he had just the energy drained from him is what he was talking about.
At what point was that? Was that before they go off to Legend's house?
Yeah, well, that was getting to Legend's. I think he was going to Legend's house. Legend wasn't quite there or something or whatever. He'd gotten there, and then, like, he went back to his car maybe to call him or some such thing, whatever. And it's like he felt like he was just, like, zapped. Like, instantly he felt like, God, I need a nap.
By being near Corbin's home.
Yeah, and that's what he was saying. Oh, my God, I wonder what was going on there. And I said, well, maybe
okay.
He put a protective spell on it or something.
Yeah, but he managed to have enough energy to take Corbin back to his home.
Yeah, as far as I know, yeah.
Okay, Bert, any topics, Bert?
Yeah, I saw in your diary where William Irvin Thompson called you the man from Lemuria.
Yes.
Why did you?
Yeah.
Is there something that you said to him that caused him to call you that?
Okay, let me look up the diary.
Before you answer that, I'm gonna hang up, Bob. It was enjoyed talking with you tonight.
Do you have any final remarks?
No, I don't think so.
Well, you should. What should you do? You're going to. Are you watching any TV, Scott?
Not so much. I watch documentaries on Netflix here and there.
Well, a short British series that Ed turned me on to that I just watched, I recommend it. It's the first, it's a TV show, but it's 100 minutes long. It's called Page 8, EIGHT. Then part two is Turks and Caicos, that island in the Caribbean, Turks and Caicos. And I think part three is starting the battlefield. Just look for the word battlefield. Those three.
You watch
movies,
that on PrimeWire? You watch that on
yeah,
still Prime watch Wire. PrimeWire?
PrimeWire. They're in MI5 intelligence topics, but it's done differently. I think you might find it interesting.
Okay, thanks for that tip.
Yeah, page 8, Turks and Caicos and something, starting the battlefield or something. Okay, you're dismissed. Okay. Thank you for your contribution.
Okay, bye-bye.
Yeah,
bye. Bye,
and now we look up Lemuria. I got my diary here. It's all ready.
The islands of Hawaii are supposed to be the peaks of Lemuria.
He doesn't call me Lemurian. I say it, Bert.
You say that? Okay.
Yeah, this is November 2nd, 1972, in New York. Thompson has left York University around that time. He's decided to quit being a teacher in Toronto and setting up the Lindisfarne. So I bumped into him at that point. And he was into sacred geometry or something like that. He was sort of taking McLuhan and going back into mathematics with mystical mandalas. So he says, there's a new geometry afoot. And I said, does it retrieve the culture of Atlantis? And he says, perhaps. And I say, well, I think we're living in the culture geometry of Lemuria. So what that means is Atlantis is the 22 land, Lemuria is the 14. You'll see that on my chart. You'll see the McLuhan quadrant. The Thompson quadrant is Atlantis, and the Croker quadrant is Lemuria. And the Lemurians, the elite could not see anybody below them. Atlantis was just more technocracy. So there's a division there, and I'm saying that Atlantis resonates more with pre-Sputnik, or pre-satellite, pre-60s reality, and the virtual class is coming in, and I'm calling that the geometry of Lemuria. It deals with the fact that, you know, the virtual class does not connect with the working classes, so that it's a geometry based on that, not on the geometry of at least a residue of visual space that you get in Atlantis. So that's what that's about.
Okay.
Now, he goes on to write a lot about Atlantis. He does a novel on Atlantis. He never really gets to Lemuria. So my statement stands tall, and he never found out what I meant.
I still don't know what you meant.
Would you say, yeah, I know, it's hard. You know, you're not going to get all the time. You know.
Well, you're living in Lemuria. You're living in the remnants of the damn place. That's what's so funny. Oh, no, it's Atlantis. It's Atlantis.
Yeah, listen to this. Listen to this. Hey, there is a fucking explanation. Now you go to December 16, 1978, my second encounter. It's all fucking explained.
Oh, let's go.
What? Did you see this one, Bert?
No, I didn't see that one, Bob. That's where I'm going.
Yeah, okay, December 1678, New York again. Now I know more about him. He wasn't anybody in 72. He had put out that book, Edge of History. I might have seen him at the McLuhan seminar, the famous encounter he had with McLuhan one night. That was around 72, I think. But he hadn't really established identity. But by 78, he did. He had written some books, and Lindisfarne was going strong. So I go, Mr. Thompson. So I attended one of their seminars. I found your seminar very stimulating. William Irwin Thompson, thank you. I noticed you during it, and I thought you looked strangely familiar. Yes, he had encountered me in 72 and probably saw me at McLuhan's. So I go, yes. Oh, look, I'm not reading ahead, but I'm sorry. I keep telling you what I'm already going to say. But I didn't know this. I go, yes, we met about 6 years ago when you first came to New York from your retreat in Toronto. We discussed the resonance of the Atlantean metaphor for our times. And, secretly I thought the Lemurian was. So he goes, oh, yes, I remember that because you emphasized Lemuria. And I've never been able to get your point. Just like Andrew, I can't get your fucking point, Bob. He's talking the future there. I've actually puzzled over it several times since then. And I say, politely, shall I attempt to explain it again? Actually, I had not explained it back then, but shall I attempt to explain it again?
Oh, Chuck!
What?
Go ahead, Bob. No, go ahead.
What, were you screaming?
No, I was shocked that he would think that. Go ahead.
Oh, okay, yeah. Shall I attempt to explain it again? He says, be my guest. I go, according to my sources, the Lemurian culture in the Pacific Ocean about 18,000 years ago was so stratified that the king and his immediate circle could not see the citizens who lived below them. The king literally could not see them. So, for example, if a bridge collapsed, the king would request the bridge to reappear. Eventually, when the bridge was rebuilt, he thought he had manifested it because he couldn't see the engineers who had actually done the job. Thompson says, that's an original idea. Now, how does it relate to Atlantis and today? I say, if we accept my description of Lemuria and the standard mythic image of Atlantis, than the current mixed corporate media oligarchy centered in Los Angeles and New York is more like Lemuria, because that simulated world, or virtual world, can't recognize the world of industrial hardware and flesh. It can't stop and acknowledge what it does to those lost worlds or how it exploits them. Thompson says, well, you've made your metaphor clearer, but I'm going to have to digest this for a little while. Let's talk about it later. Then, now, here comes a descriptive thing. End of conversation with that. Let's talk about it later. Then it says, just at that moment, Gregory Bateson came over to Thompson, nodded knowingly at Bob, and escorted Thompson over to the other side of the room for a private tete-a-tete. Bob turned and bumped into Margaret Lloyd, a regular at the Lindisfarne seminars, who was the seventh-generation direct descendant on the female side of Benjamin Franklin. And remember, we played her session with the Evergreens talking about Ben Franklin.
Benjamin Franklin. There you go. My favorite
guy. Your favorite guy.
Well, I had a doll. I was programmed at an early age. A Benjamin Franklin doll.
Now, here's the significant point. That's December 16th. The next day, I'm with Thompson's enemy, LaRouche. Okay? So I said, Lynn, have you ever noticed that the central feature of all machines is rotation? LaRouche, who was interested in that kind of stuff, he developed this years later. He goes, now that's a mouthful, Bob. I'll have to think about such a sweeping generalization, but my first impression is it has the ring of fact. I've been so busy with our new book, Dope Inc., I haven't had time to think about those kinds of patterns the past year. But I think such an idea gives me a little jolt in the direction I should now go to clear my head of our drug war work. Once again, Bob, thanks for the door to fresh air. See, all the holy offices, they like me. I show up, give them a little hint, planting seeds. Santa Clausing all over the place. Let's see what happens next. That's December 17th. The next one is me and Dieter, February 6th, 79. That's interesting. Then me and Flaps, who I sent into the LaRouche cult. Here's a good one. Jean de Saltzman. She's the inheritor of the Gurdjieff legacy. When he died in 49 or so, or according to Ion, he didn't. I don't think he did die. He was from another world or something, like Sun Ra. But Jean de Saltzman was the woman who took over the Gurdjieff organization, who Jim George, the guy who got us into Mir back in 1990, he went to Paris and met Saltzman about 6 months after Gurdjieff died. Just missed meeting Gurdjieff, and then was very prominent in the New York faction of the Gurdjieff world from that point on, 50s on. So Jean de Saltzman says, Mr. Dobbs, in the few times I've heard you talk privately to Krishnamurti, I'm always struck that you bring full sentences out of him. He doesn't mumble symbols shyly as he usually does in private conversation. He even uses the word I when he talks to you. Do you realize how unusual that is? I go, I don't think so. He's always talked that way around me, which is the same way he talked to my father years ago when I first met Mr. Judo through Rene being my father. Saltzman, so your father is to blame? I said, I hope so.
Hold on, who is this, Gurdjieff you're talking about, or what?
Gurdjieff's successor. Gurdjieff, she took over and ran the Gurdjieff thing after he died. She's famous in the Gurdjieff world. Now, that's April 2nd, 79 in Switzerland. Now, Bob is back in L.A. with Zappa. Let's see what we say in August 28, 79. Frank, you hit the nail on the head with that theme of banning music in Joe's garage. And Zappa says, yeah, look at what the Ayatollah is doing in Iran. That was right when the Ayatollah took over Iran in early 79. And they banned Western music, which was this theme that Frank had in his albums in 79 with the mini opera Joe's Garage. So I'm congratulating him on that. And he goes, oh, yes, but I want to warn you, there's going to be a rise in fundamentalist political activity here in America, mainly through the Republican Party, over the next few years. Your scenario will look more like the news than science fiction. Zappa says, if you're right, then those are some of my worst fears come true. I say, it's unfortunate, but it's going to knock the wind out of a lot of the mood of electric autonomy that motivated much of the frenzy of the 70s. Frank turned back, so that was that. I just said, it's going to knock the a wind out of the, a lot of the mood of electric autonomy that motivated much of the frenzy of the 70s. That would be partly of the vibe of the 60s that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
So the counter-reaction sets in. So then I say Frank turned back to his editing console, but he also turned on his television to catch the news. He was a great consumer of news. So the thing is there, when he puts out his autobiography 10 years later, he talks about the guy who turned him on to the fundamentalists just before Reagan got in, and how that gave him the heads up. It's all through the 80s he was warning about the moral majority, before the moral majority sort of even anybody knew about. Just that Frank knew that Reagan was going to bring him in. And he never says who he got that information from, but this is where he got it. He got it from me, August 28th, 1979.
He had to turn back to his palate, the news.
Did you say palate, P-A-L-A-T-E?
There you go. Yeah.
No, that's a good statement. That's right, because he was using
what was going on as his ability to make his painting or whatever you want to call it.
He's a journalist. He always said that he was a journalist, and he would turn the how people would think was visual news, he turned into a musical composition. That was what he did. Yeah, you're right. He monitored the mixed corporate media, picked up the rhythms, and then made his music around the news.
Bob, do you know offhand what album Frank made that made fun of televangelists?
Oh, it's either You Are What You Is, which came out in 1980, or Tinseltown Rebellion. I think it's You Are What You Is. And they're both albums in the 80s as a result of this conversation from me.
Wow.
And look at this. Here's out. Garrett. I played Garrett last week, didn't I? A couple weeks ago? Played Garrett?
Yeah.
October 14, 79, in Dallas. Dobbs. So I'm on the phone. Garrett, if I fly up to Dartmouth, will you go to Apocalypse Now with me? Garrett says, no, Bob. I will not go to a movie that treats the word apocalypse so casually. You wouldn't go to the movie. He objected to this rather casual use of the word apocalypse.
they got nutty, too, in the 90s. I remember I was over there and was watching Apocalypse on the TV, and I remember this guy in a youth hostel there in Portugal. Just the Henry the Navigator's place or whatnot. I was watching
Henry the Navigator, right?
Yeah, and I was there. They had it up this whole little, it was like a black and white TV. It was just bizarre. It was like, you know, little American guy, you know, over there in the 90s, going back to the third world and Europe, nonetheless. I was like, oh, it's a shock. And I'm watching this thing, and of course, all in Portuguese and whatnot, but I'm kind of laughing at the bits and pieces, you know, where they're out there surfing, you know, either surf or you fight, that kind of thing. And this guy's just looking at me, just like eyes wide open. He's just like, he wasn't looking at the screen as much as he was looking at me, just, you know, like, you know, bug. In a jar. It was the most bizarre thing.
Well, what, I don't know if I tuned out, what did you do to make him look at you?
I think I was just, he was an American, you know, it's like, you know, here before this odd piece of American, I don't know what, you know, I was just, here it was on Portuguese TV, and of course it was years after it was made, and so I'm watching
only
this and laughing
years.
And so forth.
Only 3 years. So what
do
you
think? I'm just saying more struck by this gentleman who owned this hostel, the way that he was looking at me watching this thing.
You're not explaining,
just,
Andrew. You're terrible.
I'm not sure. No, I'm waiting for you to chime in.
Say?
I'm
you're
trying
watching
to
TV, and a guy's just say quickly what you said that made him have his eyes bug out. Just say that sentence.
That's what I'm asking. I'm waiting for you to interject and tell me something in McLuhan that's supposed to highlight this experience, because I don't know why this guy thought that was just, you know, because he knew I was an American.
We're not getting, what did you say? Why did the guy have bug eye? What did you do?
Yeah, because he saw it was like an American watching this strange American film about Vietnam, and he was
Portuguese. Are you saying that he's Portuguese and you're an American? Is that what you're saying?
Right. Yes, he was. He was he was the owner of the of this particular youth hostel, and it happened to have been Henry the Navigator's residence or whatnot, or his school, if you will.
Yeah, the Sinclairs. The Sinclairs. They do Island Treasury thing.
Okay, I'm just telling you, I was there, and it was turned into a youth
hostel.
He's staring
at you because you didn't say anything.
No, he's staring at me. I just remember sitting there watching, and it was that movie. It was Apocalypse Now, and I'm laughing because, you know, there are parts that are just hilarious, even in Portuguese, because I'd seen it already. And this guy was, like, staring at me. And I thought it had to do with, you know, here's this American, and let's see how he reacts to this odd American movie. I mean, what would you take?